This is Jerry Osborne welcoming you to Book Lovers Cafe. And the reason I've been asked to interview Alec Whiteman, whose debut book is Music in My Life, Notes from a Longtime Fan. Coincidentally, I have used the phrase "music is my life" for decades on my radio shows, so I seemed appropriate to chat with Alec.
I look forward to our conversation because one of the great benefits that has come from writing this book is having folks like you come out of the woodwork.
Oh my, oh my. How did you know I had just gotten out of the woodwork?
Yes. Read the book and inspired thoughts and memories in their own minds of their own experiences. Not so much just things I wrote about, but their own lives. So, you know, this will be a fun conversation.
Okay, Alec, let's begin with chapter one. It is titled My Big Bang. Now, summarize for us your encounter of your Big Bang.
Well, as I write in the book, the first song that spoke to me was actually December of 1961, and it was Dion and his song, The Wanderer. Obviously, at some point during that year, so this would have been the fall of my sixth grade year, I began listening to the radio and listening to rock and roll and enjoying it. But that song made an impact on me, and I, looking back on it now, you know, how did a 10-year-old kid in Euclid, Ohio, get impacted by a 20 or 21-year-old Italian-American from the Bronx? But it was rock and roll, and it spoke to me, and it took off from there. When I heard The Wanderer, and obviously rock and roll had caught my attention, I asked, you know, my mother wanted to know what I wanted for Christmas, and I said, rock and roll records. And, of course, she didn't have the faintest idea what she was doing, but she went up to a little independent record store on Lakeshore Boulevard in Euclid, Ohio, called Demshar's, and a gentleman at the store put together a collection of records for her to give me for Christmas that year. And one of them was Dion and the Belmonts' Greatest Hits. As I look back on it, to be honest with you, I'm not even sure Run Around Sue was on that record, but I clearly caught that song looking back just a few months because it was the predecessor hit to The Wanderer. But at that point, I then was introduced to all the songs Dion and the Belmonts had done in the late 50s. And of course, I thought the same as about Dion as a solo artist. The hits that followed, you mentioned Lovers Who Wander, and you know, Little Diane and Love Came to Me, and all those songs that came out in 61 and 62, you know, were great songs. He captured a sound. And of course, one of the things that impacted me is even as a kid, I began to focus on who wrote the songs. And Dion wrote a lot of his own material, so that was a big thing as well. Well, and in fact, it kind of slipped away from us. You know, you go back to the story of Elvis going into the army and Little Richard going into the ministry and Jerry Lee Lewis going wherever he went. A couple of guys went down in a plane crash. Not Dion, who didn't get on that plane, even though he was there. And rock and roll kind of slid back, and from my perspective, in 62, 63, it slid back to more of an easy listening, more of a pop sound. You know, the edge came off it for a couple of years, only to have the Brits show up in 64, 65, giving our music back to us with a new edge, which was, took us off into what to me, even to these days, are the glory years of rock and roll, the mid-late 60s into the early 70s.
Well, Alec, since I'm a few years older than you, I'm wondering if you were somehow exposed to much of the great rock and roll before 1961.
You know, the 55, 56, 57 era, I missed. I was just too young, and it was only, much later that you know, the music from those years, jumped out at me. But the truth is, you know, the Beatles, the Stones, when those guys first came over here, they had honed their craft in the clubs and bars of the UK and Europe, doing cover songs. I mean, the Stones maybe a little more R&B influenced, the Beatles kind of Everly Brothers influenced. So in many respects, what they came back with in 64 and 65, or what they came to this country with. I was a very busy corporate lawyer. I've been a partner in the national law firm of Baker Hostetler since 1982, and got involved in law firm management. So in addition to a pretty big law practice and then some management responsibilities, I had a day job. But I, have been a rock and roll fan for 60 years. And as you suggest, starting in 1995, at the peak of my career, and for, decades after that as a busy lawyer, I began to promote national act singer-songwriter shows here in Columbus. As a busy lawyer, that was my outlet. I had other things, too. I had kids. I played a lot of serious tennis. But I was promoting shows and continue to do so till this day. 60 years of being a rock and roll fan, 27 years at this point of promoting national act singer-songwriter shows in Columbus. And then in 2004, I went on the board of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, took it very seriously, ended up chairing that board. And I guess it's those three things, the fandom, the promotion, and the Rock Hall. They give me a lot of stories to tell, and folks would say you ought to write a book, and I would roll my eyes, never thinking for a second I would do that, until late 2016. I had a knee replacement. It brought my tennis days. I was still playing tennis three or four times a week, and I put that aside. And then my wife, who's just fine now, had some health issues the following year, and I decided to put some of those stories down.
Fortunately, the dreaded COVID-19 hasn't affected my radio shows, although I have taken all of the appropriate vaccinations and booster. But how do you fare with all of that for the last couple of years?
Well, the book wouldn't have come to fruition without the pandemic. We'll give it credit, the silver lining in the cloud. Yes, late 2016, I had time on my hands, really for the first time in a long time, and I thought about doing a book, and I just began to take notes on 3x5 index cards, the names of artists, concerts I went to, albums that I remembered, stories that I could tell. And I had a pretty good-sized stack of notes, and then I spent... I'm a lawyer. I think in linear fashion or an outline fashion, so I spent a lot of time organizing them, trying to decide, how I might present it if I was going to actually start to write, and ended up settling on what I call a chronological with fast forwards approach. And I started to write, and I probably got a third of the way into those that stack of index cards. And I didn't 100% like where I was going, and I put it down. I went back at some point and edited it, cleaned it up a little bit. But I never really started writing again until the pandemic. And mid-March of last year, 2020, boy, did I have time on my hands. And I was holed up in the home office where I'm sitting today in Columbus, Ohio. And I thought, what the heck? And I began to write, took it seriously, 3 or 4 hours probably at least every day, wrote and edited, researched as I went along to kind of jog my memory or clarify the facts or whatever. When I was done, I had what I now know is called a manuscript. I didn't know that at the time.
Who would have thought that something so good could have come out from something so disastrous?
When we look back on the pandemic experience, we'll probably see some other good things that came out of it. One of the things I comment on from time to time is some of the things we're seeing today coming out of the pandemic were just the acceleration of trends that were already in place. Hopefully we'll learn from some of the things that we had to do during that pandemic. We'll learn how to do things better going forward. But having said that, that's clearly an attempt to try to see the glass half full, because for most of it was a pretty miserable experience.
How and why can Connie Francis not be in the Hall of Fame? Because she should have been in when Brenda Lee was there at the same time, because they're both on an equal level of popularity and sales. And I don't know, but it just seems like she's like the most obvious of all time. Alec, what do you think about, or what do you have to say about why Connie Francis isn't there? Did she bite somebody?
Well, that's an excellent question to which, unfortunately, I do not have a good answer. You may know that the process involves a nominating committee, which is chaired by John Landau, Bruce Springsteen's longtime manager. And it contains 25 or 30 people. Greg Harris, who's my good friend, who's the CEO of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, is on that nominating committee.
Uh-huh.
But so are a bunch of music industry folks, but also a number of musicians. And in fact, they've moved of late to try to get a little, you know, younger and more diverse group in the room. But they take that process very seriously, and as I understand it, you know, on an annual basis, that group convenes and for a day or two, and each person on the committee is allowed to bring forward two suggestions, and they debate it and kick it around and end up taking it to a vote, hoping to come up with about 15 nominees. And then that list of nominees, the list that emerged from the nominating committee, is put on a ballot and sent out to what I guess today is up to about 1,000 voters, the predominant component of which is every living person who's been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So, you know, every solo artist, every band member who was actually inducted, because some of these bands, you know, have changed personnel and not everybody gets inducted. And so they all cast their vote, and the goal being to come down to, you know, five or six voted inductees. I've been on the board of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Foundation. So that's the organization that has the intellectual property rights and does the induction ceremony. I've also been on the board of the entity that owns and operates the building. That's the one I chaired for a few years. But I'm on the board of the foundation, and as a result, I get a vote. I'm not on the nominating committee, but I do get a vote. And I have to tell you, I have not. Connie Francis has not emerged out of that nominating committee. She's never been on the ballot since I've been involved, which would be about 2013. And I don't have a good explanation for that. Well, there is no question, and you know, one of the criticisms of the hall, and deservedly so to some extent, but it's probably a broader criticism as it relates to rock and roll generally, is the extent to which women have been underrepresented, and that's something I know the nominating committee and the voters are sensitive to. And you know, you saw this year's induction class, and Tina Turner and Carole King both being inducted for the second time, Tina having been in once with Ike, and Carole having been inducted previously as a writer, and the Go-Go's, you know, and so there, you know, there's clearly a sensitivity to making sure women are adequately represented. And your suggestion is a good one. Maybe I can slip a note to one of my friends that's in that nominating room and tell them they ought to take a look at her body of work, as they say.
I've never had the opportunity to ask anyone about yes. that, and I appreciate you telling me what you knew.
Or don't.
Oh,
or
don't.
Yes.
Here are a couple of more that maybe certainly might be qualified. I think they are. Neil Sedaka and Pat Boone. There's a couple that could very well have been nominated, so they could think about that too.
Well, there's no question. And Neil Sedaka in particular, in addition to being you know, a wonderful performer and on his own, also wrote a bunch of great songs.
A lot.
Brill Building alum. I have heard Pat Boone suggested a time or two as a possible nominee. Once again, in my experience, since I've been on the foundation board since 2013, he's never made it out of the nominating committee. Whether he was ever seriously considered there, I'm not sure. Well, the whole Dion experience, and you know, we started there with our conversation a few minutes ago. Hearing The Wanderer in 1961, becoming, you know, somewhat infatuated with Dion and his music and following him, and, you know, not knowing at the time that he had a deep and serious heroin addiction at the peak of his career. And, you know, he faded in the mid-60s, disappeared from sight, at least to most of us. Got sober, by the way, in the late 60s. But then came back with Abraham Martin and John, that wonderful song in 1969 or 70 or whatever year that was.
It hit the charts in late 1968.
And then stayed out there. You know, he went through a bit of a gospel period. But, you know, he kept making music. And then, as I recount in the book, and the book, as I say, is a lot of, you know, it's chronological with fast forwards. So the book opens with Dion, and the truth is it ends with Dion, because a couple of years ago I got wind of a musical that was being put together called The Wanderer, about his life and, you know, using his music to tell the story. And did something that I've advised clients for 40 years not to do. And I invested in a Broadway musical. And right before the pandemic, had the, you know, wonderful opportunity to go to Midtown Manhattan into a rehearsal space, the kind of space I didn't even know existed, where folks can come and practice and rehearse and work on everything from concert performances to Broadway musicals and so on. So went there for a reading of The Wanderer, where they were going to do all the music and the folks who were going to star in the production, which at that point was scheduled to open just a couple of months later, would do a run-through, and those of us who had invested, and I'm sure some prospective investors were invited. And so I went, and, you know, one of the magic moments of my life, Dion pulls up a folding chair and brings it over and sits down next to me, and there I am for 4 hours sitting next to, you know, my childhood idol, watching a musical about his life unfold in front of us, and, you know, talking and chatting.
I saw that photo in the book.
Yes, yep, that's me, and my wife took that picture.
A good photographer. By the way, Dion has a new album that probably will be in my hands in the next couple weeks.
He does, and that's the second new album he has had in just a few, last couple of years, where he's been able to get everybody from Bruce Springsteen and Patti Sciolfa to Van Morrison to mm-hmm. Joe Bonamassa and lots of other folks to do duets with him, and that's a sign both of how vital he remains today at the age of 81 or whatever he is, and the extent to which he is revered by folks in the music industry even today. The truth is, I don't think they matched him or anything close to what he was doing as a solo artist in those years, but you may have a better recollection of that than I do.
You probably remember when Dion went solo, the Belmonts also went solo, so they were both on the charts with their hits for a period of time. Just mentioning it only because they did have some hits.
I never had the DJ experience, although the truth is, certainly once cassette tapes were invented, and then CDs, and now even streaming playlists, I have put probably hundreds of lists together, playing a disc jockey myself. And whether it's themed around something going on in the world, or just capturing the mood, or just the spontaneity of the moment, I have always, I guess, had a secret desire to be a disc jockey. Oh, to the contrary, I think I would revel in the commonality.
One thing that I don't want to fail to mention while we're talking is I'd like you to tell the people how they can find your book, Music in My Life, Notes from a Longtime Fan. How do they get it?
Well, it's available really on probably every online bookseller, whether you go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble online, it is certainly there. It's called Music in My Life, Notes from a Longtime Fan. And I'm Alec Whiteman, W-I-G-H-T-M-A-N. And so putting any of those pieces of information into the Amazon site or one of the others will bring it up, and you can buy it that way. I think most independent booksellers participate in some online distribution network, so you can even go into your local store and order it.
And best of all, it has the Jerry Osborne seal of approval.
And I'm thrilled to have that be the case. You'll be my Oprah Book Club.
It's a lot of fun talking to you, Alec. It really was. And we are two peas in a pod, that's for sure.
Well, Jerry, once again, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. But I have to tell you, you're not the first person who has come into my life as a result of this book with whom that commonality exists. Rock and roll has obviously been a common language for many of us, not just around this country, but around the world. And one of the thrills of the book has been the extent to which my memories and my thoughts and insights have triggered those of others who then reach out to me, and we can have conversations like this. So it's been an absolute blast, and I thank you.
So, Alec, I'm really happy to be able to talk to you today, and I look forward to maybe getting together again sometime.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure, and I'd be pleased to do it as well, whether we do it over the phone or on the air, or who knows, maybe you'll make a trip to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, or I'll get up to your neck of the woods in the state of Washington, and we'll meet face to face.
I'll be there when they induct Connie. What a great time to go there.
Well, I would very much appreciate that, and not only that, I'll, post it on my Facebook page and, any of those other things. That, I've got a website about the book and can put a link to it there.
Okay, great.
I'll see what we can do.
As a lifelong Top 40 format DJ, I appreciated your mention in the first chapter of a local DJ who was influential in the early 60s. Can I get you to share that with our audience? It's a part of your R&R history.
From 1960 to 1964, the guy who had the afternoon drive time at WHK in Cleveland, Johnny Holiday, introduced me to rock and roll. I'd come home from school, and his show was on the air. And I'm just a kid. And I referenced him in the book. And I did an author talk here in Columbus, and the guy who was going to interview me had the initiative to reach out and get a hold of Holiday, who's now 81, 82 years old, and is still the voice of the University of Maryland football and basketball. He's a play-by-play announcer for both after a long career as a disc jockey. And he's done that for 30 years at Maryland. And so he had the guy, Johnny, call in when I was on stage with, 75 people in front of me, and we had a conversation. Well, Holiday and I have become friends to the point that when he was here to do the Maryland-Ohio State game a few weeks ago, we had dinner the night before. And I'm going to Washington, D.C. next week to do an author talk in Washington, D.C. Tuesday night, and I'm hoping to have lunch with him Monday when I'm there. So, long way of saying, new friendships have been made with this book, and hopefully you and I'll do just that.
We owe it all to the book.
And to rock and roll.
Yeah, well, that too. Yeah. You can't have one without the other.
Well, the book wouldn't exist.
Great talking to you.
Thanks, Jerry.
Okay, Alec.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, it really does seem appropriate to spin the most important record in Alex's music adventure, and that is The Wanderer by Dion.
I know a rosy on my chest, 'cause I'm a wanderer. Yeah.